Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the person who Vladimir Putin desperately wants to murder, Bill Browder, the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets, whose lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was tortured and killed in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud by Russian government officials. Bill campaigned to have the Magnitsky Act signed into U.S. law in 2012, and Putin, who personally received some of the stolen money, is obsessed with getting the act repealed. Apparently, Putin got Trump to agree to what our president said was, quote, an incredible offer to turn over Browder and U.S. Ambassador Michael McFaul to Putin in exchange for U.S. access to 12 Russian military intelligence officers recently indicted by Robert Mueller. With today's Senate vote of 98-0 on a resolution urging Trump not to honor Putin's request, we will discuss how Browder has been trying to avoid getting killed by Putin's regime for the last 10 years and how Putin is terrified that the Magnitsky Act could be applied to his offshore fortune, estimated to be between $50 and $200 billion. Then we'll speak with Daniel Serwer, Professor of Conflict Management at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, who served as a special envoy and mediator between Croats and Muslims at the Dayton peace talks and facilitated dialogue between Serbs and Albanians in the Balkans. He joins us to discuss how Trump, in a softball interview on Fox News, cavalierly dismissed NATO's newest member, Montenegro, as being unworthy of NATO's defense under Article 5 of the treaty, and even accused the tiny Balkan country of being so aggressive that it could start World War III. Then finally, we will analyze what appears to be the only possible agreement to emerge from the secret talks between Putin and Trump, and that is some kind of promise by Russia to make sure that when Russia's client Assad is restored to power in Syria, the Israelis will not be threatened by Iran as Trump abandons the U.S. position in Syria, selling out the Kurds and giving ISIS a reprieve. A specialist on Greater Syria, James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA, joins us to discuss Trump's gullibility in believing the absurd Russian promise to rein in the Iranians in Syria to help Israel. And joining us now is Bill Browder, chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since 2009, when his lawyer Sergei Magnitsky died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain individuals involved in Magnitsky's death. And he has an article in Time magazine, I'm Bill Browder. Here's the biggest mistake Putin made when trying to get access to me through Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Browder.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Well, thank you. And it's good that you are alive and breathing. It's extraordinary that the President of the United States appeared to accept an offer from President Putin to have you and former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, go to Russia in exchange for the U.S. having access to the 12 GRU Russian military officers named in the Mueller indictment. It is amazing to think that the President of the United States said that was an incredible offer, but now the U.S. Senate has voted 98-0 to oppose the idea of having Putin interrogate you, and that happened just before that vote. Of course, the President reversed himself on what apparently he was considering doing. So the fact that it got this far is pretty shocking, don't you think, Bill Browder?
I do. I think it's quite an extraordinary, I would say, low point in Trump's presidency to effectively agree to hand over a bunch of people who have been working to try to keep the Russian aggression in check and hand them over to the Russian aggressors. It's kind of like it would be like agreeing to hand over a bunch of Marines to be interrogated by ISIS. It's truly remarkable.
Well, the one thing, though, that is consistent with this strange relationship that was on display at the press conference. And, of course, we don't know what went on in the two-hour secret meeting that took place prior to that. The White House is announcing today that the president plans to invite President Putin to Washington for another meeting in the fall. So that's pretty surprising, don't you think, in the light of what's happening in the last couple of days?
Well, I think the most surprising thing is that this summit even took place in Helsinki in the first place. Putin doesn't deserve to be put on the same stage as the most powerful man in the free world, the American president. Putin is a menace to the world. He's invaded Ukraine. He's bombed innocent women and children in Syria. He shot down passenger planes. He's cheated in the Olympics. He's meddled in elections in the United States and Britain and France and Germany. He's set out chemical weapons in the heart of England. This is a guy who is just a true world criminal, and to put him on the same stage as the most powerful man in the free world in Helsinki was a total mistake, and to dignify him with a visit to the United States is even worse.
Did you get the impression, as many did, that there's some peculiar body language going on there between the two of them, that it's almost as if our president is intimidated by Russia's president and may even be afraid of him?
Well, I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not going to speculate on body language. What I can say, and this is where the situation gets very confusing, is that the people who surround President Trump, Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Jim Mattis, the Defense Secretary, John Bolton, his National Security Advisor, Nikki Haley, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, are all real clear-eyed hawks as far as Russia goes, and have created a U.S. policy towards Russia, which I would say is suitably tough. The sanctions against the Russian oligarchs, which the United States put in place, were tough. Offensive weapons to Ukraine are tough. The fact that the U.S. military wiped out an entire division of Russian mercenaries in Syria is tough. That's on one side. And then you have this weird schizophrenia on the other side, where you have Donald Trump himself, the president of the United States, making all these absolutely offensive statements, praising Vladimir Putin and giving him all these sort of accolades and respect, which just doesn't make any sense to me. And it's either something sinister or it's something completely ill-advised. But in either case, it shouldn't be happening.
And Bill Browder, you, of course, are the grandson of the former head of the American Communist Party. Then you went to Russia, where you became the most successful foreign investor in Russia. And even though the offer by Putin to Trump, which Trump appeared to entertain, to have you and Ambassador McFaul, in a sense, swapped for the 12 Russians, and if you went to Russia, I assume you would be dead shortly thereafter. But the reality is that Putin's going to have to ask Theresa May, you're a British citizen, and I don't think she's particularly disposed to doing any favors after the Novichok nerve gas use in Salisbury against a Russian exile, and then the collateral damage of a British woman and her partner. The British woman died. Apparently, she found in a dumpster a perfume bottle that was used to bring the Novichok from Russia to Salisbury.
Yeah, well, what I can say about the UK is that Putin and his government have already made 12 requests similar to the one that was made to President Trump. And all of those 12 requests, long before this Novichok fiasco, were rejected outright immediately by the government without any questions asked, as being not in the national interest of the United Kingdom. And so the British government has been on my side legally and protecting me legally for a long time. And so I have no worries about Theresa May ever doing any of this nonsense.
So why is Putin apparently obsessed with you, and in particular undoing the Magnitsky Act that you're responsible for getting passed here in the U.S. Congress? And this has become an international phenomenon. There is the Global Magnitsky Justice Campaign, and so far a number of other countries, including the U.K., Canada, and the Baltic states have signed on, and 8 other countries are considering the Magnitsky Act. That's Sweden, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Australia, South Africa, and Ukraine. So the Magnitsky Act, is, as you say in your piece in Time magazine, is going viral, while Putin seems to be going off the deep end.
Well, so it's pretty simple why Putin is so upset by this. Putin is a crook. He's a kleptocrat. He steals money from people and from state institutions in Russia, and he keeps that money in the West, and he kills people to steal that money. And what the Magnitsky Act says is that those people who do killing in Russia will have their assets seized in the West. And so it perfectly applies to Vladimir Putin himself. And he justifiably, he's right in thinking this, is that his money is at risk. And so he takes this personally. This is not a theoretical thing. This is not a thing where he's mad at some on the basis of national interest. He's personally mad because he's stolen a lot of money and that money will be frozen. And that's why he's so mad at me, because who would have thought that one individual could go and create such trouble for him? But I've done just that.
Well, but he must want you dead. I mean, he's killed other people for less, hasn't he?
He wants me dead, but he wants to do it in a way that he doesn't get caught. And the best way for him to kill me without getting caught is to arrest me, bring me back to Russia in his own territory, in his own prisons, and then kill me quietly and plausibly deniably. And that's his strategy, and that's what I'm trying to prevent right now, and that's what I have prevented so far. And so that's why I went to Trump and thought, well, Browder spends a bit of time in America, maybe Trump will hand him over. And for a few minutes, Trump thought, yeah, maybe.
Well, that was the exchange before the White House press secretary, you know, that the Trump team is considering it. Everybody was absolutely dumbstruck that this should be rejected out of hand. Did you have a moment of disquiet?
No. Not a moment of disquiet. I mean, if you looked at this thing, it wasn't just me that they were after. I mean, so and let me just put this in the details, because the details are so shocking. So there were 11 other people that the Russians wanted access to, that Putin wanted access to, and each of these 11 people had done one of two things. They either been government officials or members of congressional staff members who had been involved in passing the Magnitsky Act, or they were law enforcement officials who had been involved in investigating the money laundering from the Magnitsky case that came to the United States. And so, and these are not businessmen who have made a lot of money or entertainers or anything like that. These were low paid, anonymous U.S. government officials working in the national interest of the United States for their country. And Russia asked Donald Trump to hand over a bunch of loyal, patriotic public servants for their country to the Russians to do whatever they're going to do. That is hardly making America great again.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Browder, chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since 2009, when his lawyer Sergei Magnitsky died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain individuals involved in Magnitsky's death. And he has an article at Time Magazine. I'm Bill Browder. Here's the biggest mistake Putin made when trying to get access to me through Trump. Well, your lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who was killed in prison, possibly on the orders of Putin, he was murdered for uncovering this $230 million government corruption scheme. And my understanding is that money ended up in Manhattan real estate. Is that your understanding?
Some of the money ended up in Manhattan real estate, and the Department of Justice then seized some of the real estate, and they got a $6 million settlement from these Russian people to try to settle the case. And the first lawyer in charge of that was Natalia Veselnitskaya, the same lawyer who went to Trump Tower. And the talking points of Natalia Veselnitskaya in her Trump Tower meeting were the same talking points that Vladimir Putin had in Helsinki. And so everything is linked to everything, and it all links up to the Magnitsky case. As some people have said to be, the Magnitsky case is like the Rosetta Stone of Putin's corruption in Russia.
So
everything comes back to it.
Right, but is it possible, and you say in the Time magazine piece that you've written, that Putin got some of these proceeds from this crime? I had heard a while back that Putin's estimated wealth stature abroad is about $50 billion. Then just the other day, a former intelligence officer said that it's as high as $200 billion. So the amount of money that he got out of the McNixie, $230 million, pales by comparison to what he's stolen. So why is he so terrified? Is this kind of the opening crack in this wall of secrecy in offshore banking?
Well, so we've investigated where the $230 million went. I've had a team of forensic investigators working for me for 8.5 years. We found all the money. It's gone to 26 different countries so far, and 15 countries have opened have live law enforcement investigations open. And what the problem for Putin is that it's not just the crime. He's got thousands of these scams going, but we've now identified the entire apparatus and the pipe, and once you start looking for one thing, you find everything, and that's why this thing is so horrifying for him.
Well, but doesn't he use cutouts like his cronies and friends, like the cello player who had a bunch of money stashed in Panama that was revealed in the Panama Papers?
Yes, but those people end up having their money frozen. And that's the problem for Putin, is that he understands that none of these accounts are in his name. They're all in names of oligarch trustees, and these oligarchs are ending up getting sanctioned and having their monies frozen.
So that's what drives him crazy, right? He feels like it's closing in on him.
Yeah, he feels the noose is tightening. There's now 15 live investigations into money laundering. There's seven countries with Magnitsky Acts. There's eight more on deck, and it's all and in fact, I mean, the irony of this whole thing is, while he's making this big effort to try to sort of attack me through Trump, all he's doing is raising the awareness of the Magnitsky case. And so I'm getting calls from European politicians who have been thinking about this before, saying, we want to get started. How do we get started with the Magnitsky Act? This sounds like something, if Putin doesn't like it, this sounds like something we should be doing.
But what does he need with all that money? I mean, you know, it's just incomprehensible. If it's $200 billion of stolen Russian money, and on top of that, you've got the Siloviki and the oligarchs that he regulates, they've stolen probably even more if you add it all up. Is Putin basically, I mean, I don't even know that he wants to retire, or he can't afford to retire. What does he want with all that money?
Well, you ask the question as a non-sociopathic, homicidal kleptocrat. If you were a sociopathic kleptocrat, you would understand his motivation. It's just he wants more and more and more, and he doesn't feel confident enough until he has more. And you're right, he's not going to spend the money because he can't ever not be president, but it's all part of his power trip. That he's got to be the most powerful, the most vicious, and have the most money. That's what it's all about for a dictator in Russia.
But like third world dictators, does he use his money as a patronage to create a patronage system?
Well, I don't think he shares any of his own money. I think he shares, you know, the proceeds from the crimes that he commits are all divvied out. He gets some, and other people get less. But the whole idea is to keep everybody loyal through oiling the machine and making sure they have enough money. And the sad thing is, all that money should be money going to the people of Russia, so that for medicine and roads and education and so on. And so all the things that the government should be spending money on, they don't. And people are living in destitution and poverty in Russia, so that Vladimir Putin and his cronies, the top 1,000 people, can have super yachts and villas all over the world and disgusting wealth that nobody needs.
But why does the Narod, why do the people in Russia like him? Or I know that polling is very suspect, and he's
very... I don't believe that people in Russia actually do like him. I think that people in Russia just sort of are afraid to say anything bad about him. There's nobody else that they can choose, because he's eliminated, but through murder and jailing and exiling anybody who's a possible competitor. And so you end up with sort of one choice, and everybody's afraid of that person. And so they just sort of go with the flow until the moment that he teeters and topples. And then everyone say, no, I never liked that guy. And he'll have a 0% support level.
Well, just in closing, what can you do to influence President Trump if he's not being blackmailed or whatever the hold is? We don't know. And we know that his real estate empire was rescued by Russian money. But what can be done to break this spell? And more by extension, even though the Senate voted today 98-0 against the idea of sending you and McFaul to Russia, nevertheless, you know, the Republicans have been pretty much in support of Trump all along. So what can be done from your point of view and from your unique experience to influence our president?
Well, I think he's a very practical man, and this is the issue. this is the one issue that he loses all of his Republican support on. When I say Republican support, I mean Republican support in Congress. Basically, every member of Congress, all 98 of them in the Senate, are not going to allow this to happen. And if he were to have handed me and McFaul over, that would have been the place where his whole thing had completely crumbled. And so he understands that the entire establishment of Washington, both Democrat and Republican, and the entire apparatus of the Defense Department and the State Department don't agree with him on this stuff. And so he doesn't really have that much degrees of freedom to do stuff with Vladimir Putin, because he can't really come to any agreement other than all this bonhomie and sort of good friend stuff, which doesn't really mean anything as long as he doesn't do anything.
Well, Bill Browder, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Bill Browder, who's the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since 2009, when his lawyer Sergei Magnitsky died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain individuals involved in Magnitsky's death. And he has an article, Time Magazine, I'm Bill Browder. Here's the biggest mistake Putin made when trying to get access to me through Trump. We take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump dismissed NATO's new member as being unworthy of NATO's defense under Article 5 and even accused Montenegro of being so aggressive that it could start World War III.
And marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Daniel Sower, who's a professor of conflict management at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Previously, he was the vice president for the Centers for Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace. And from 1994 to 1996, he served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims and negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also blogs at peacefair.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Sower.
My pleasure.
And first of all, I recall at the last NATO meeting, the one before this current disaster, Donald Trump sort of charged on the stage where all the NATO heads of state were mingling, and he bumped this guy out of the way, and then he sort of preened like, you know, a peacock, puffed his chest out and stood in front of everybody else. And, of course, the guy that he nudged aside in a rather humiliating way was the president of Montenegro, was he not?
Yes, he was. So, I don't think the president knew that, though, at the time.
Right. I'm sure he didn't care. But how do you reconcile, though, what he said in this interview that he did with Fox News' Tucker Carlson, where in conversation, Carlson said, "Why should my son go to Montenegro to defend it from attack?" And President Trump replied, "I understand what you're saying. I've also asked the same question." And then he went on to say, "Montenegro is a tiny country with very strong people. They're very aggressive people. They may get aggressive, and congratulations, you're in World War III." This has not gone down well in Montenegro, but what did you make of it?
I thought it was probably something that Putin had said to him. and that he repeated.
Well, that sort of makes sense. Didn't Putin try to assassinate the leader of Montenegro?
Yes, he did. Milo Djukanovic was in the prime minister in late 2016, and Russia tried to assassinate him. There are people on trial now in Montenegro for that attempted assassination.
And Montenegro shares a border with Serbia that is very pro-Russian. So Montenegro obviously has a security problem, do they not, with the Russians?
I don't really think so. Actually, Serbia, which is friendly with Russia, is also friendly with Montenegro. And in fact, the Serbs were instrumental in preventing the coup attempt from being successful. They actually helped to inform the Montenegrins and helped to the Montenegrins to understand precisely who was in on the plot. So I think there is no serious problem between Serbia and Montenegro. Before a country can enter NATO, it needs to settle all its major issues with its neighbors. That's one of the requirements of entering NATO. And Montenegro has done that. It has no significant difficulties with any of its neighbors. It doesn't even have a significant difficulty with Russia. Russian investors are major investors, especially in real estate in Montenegro. But Putin is determined to try to prevent NATO from expanding any further, so it would be quite natural for him to exaggerate Montenegro's aggressiveness. Let's be very clear. Montenegro is not aggressive. If there is a single country in the Balkans that has assiduously and successfully tried to stay out of war since 1992, it's Montenegro.
Well, it has an army of around 2,000 with 400 reservists, so that doesn't strike me as being a threat to anybody.
It is not a threat to anybody, nor does anybody really threaten Montenegro, including Russia, which doesn't have time and energy to bother. This was a political maneuver by Putin to try to prevent any further NATO expansion by putting doubts in the mind of the President of the United States, who really doesn't know where Montenegro is and doesn't care less.
Well, Montenegro is obviously has some important coastal ports, does it not? Is there any strategic interest in that by either NATO?
The Russians, were quite interested in using Montenegro's port, and the Montenegrins said a firm no to them before they entered NATO, and they probably wouldn't at this point want to say yes. But I hasten to add that I've been in Montenegro and seen Russian ships in port. I mean, there's no problem with Russian ships going into port in Montenegro. The issue is whether they could have a real base there and some guarantees of access there. And the answer from Montenegro to that question was no.
So could you then say that Russia is losing influence in the Balkans?
Well, it has certainly lost influence in Montenegro, but it continues to support anti-NATO, anti-Djukanovic, anti-democratic forces in Montenegro. So it's not completely out of Montenegro. Macedonia now has an invitation to join NATO, so I think it will be losing influence there too, though it will try very hard to prevent Macedonia from joining NATO, which it can do because Macedonia has to settle an big issue with Greece before it can become a member of NATO. I would say Russia, yes, is losing influence in the Balkans, but it's not a negligible factor there, and in fact has been pumping weapons into both Bosnia and Serbia in an effort to gain a foothold in both places. It has a foothold in both places.
Well, I imagine, though, the real significance of this extraordinary exchange between the Fox host Tucker Carlson and President Trump, which was recorded the day after, I think, or maybe the same day of that press conference that has alarmed so many people around the world and here in the United States, that where essentially what Trump was saying was that he's really indifferent to Article 5. Would that be your interpretation?
Yes, it would be. He was saying, why should we go fight for Montenegro? The short answer to that question is that it's because Montenegro has been willing to fight for us. Montenegro has deployed troops with NATO to Afghanistan. It's also deployed troops to Liberia and Cyprus with the UN, to Somalia with the EU. We get a lot out of our allies. The commitment to defend them is more than compensated, in my view, by their willingness to defend us. And it's well known, of course, that the only time the mutual defense obligation of the NATO treaty has been triggered is right after 9/11, when the Europeans agreed to help the United States in Afghanistan.
So, I mean, this is hard for me to understand why Putin has, in quotes, won in Syria. You know, when he sent his aircraft, his only aircraft carrier down there, it broke down and had to sort of limp into port. And it just, I find it extraordinary that we have a president who has secret meetings with this Russian leader. We don't know what the agenda is. We know that the Democrats have been trying to get hearings so that the interpreter, the State Department interpreter, could at least explain what went on in this meeting and what was agreed to. We're getting readouts from the Russians. They're saying what was agreed to, but they're not exactly the most reliable and credible sources. And yet our own president, our own White House, won't tell us what they agreed to. And there's a real sense that Trump is going to sell out the Syrian opposition if he hasn't already done so.
I think he's already done that. He's cut off assistance to the Syrian opposition, both armed resistance and civilian resistance. I don't know what he's gotten in return for this in Syria. He's implied that he might have gotten some agreement for Iranian withdrawal from the border with Israel, but that's, in my view, more than likely an imaginary agreement like his agreement with Kim Jong-un for denuclearization. The fact is that we don't know what he's agreed to. We don't really know what the agenda was, and we have every reason to believe that anything he agreed to will be more to Putin's liking than to American liking.
Well, that's an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it?
It's an extraordinary thing to say, but I think it's quite clear that the President of the United States takes Putin's side on many issues. For him to even to have considered questioning of a former American ambassador by the Russian authorities is just completely outrageous. We have a president who prides himself on breaking prior molds. And what that means in the case of Putin is doing the things, or at least considering doing the things that Putin wants him to do.
So do you feel, like many others, that there is something that Putin must hold over him and it would be really important to know what it is, if indeed it is some kind of...
I think it's quite clear that the Trump real estate empire depends heavily on Russian financing, and that that is certainly a factor. One thing we know about the president is his concern with his money. And that has to be an important factor. Whether there's anything else, I don't really know. There's a lot of speculation, and I expect Mr. Mueller to reveal the details in due course.
That's if the Tea Party caucus in the House doesn't succeed in their obvious ploy, which is to make completely unreasonable demands on the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, force him to turn over the work product of the Mueller investigation, which is top secret and would end up very shortly thereafter on Fox News. And Rosenstein has to refuse them. And in doing so, they may well find that as an excuse to proceed with impeachment against him. And then, of course, Donald Trump could say, well, how can we have a deputy attorney general who's being impeached by the House? Do you see that as a possible future scenario?
I suppose it's possible, but I think one thing is clear. If Mr. Mueller were to be fired, whatever he has discovered will become public. This is a game of chicken, and I think Mr. Mueller is holding the trump cards, so, if I can mix metaphors.
Right. That was an appropriate pun. So just in the last couple of minutes, and returning to the Balkans and this extraordinary exchange between President Trump and the Fox News host Tucker Carlson, criticizing Montenegro and suggesting that this tiny little country could start World War III and calling them aggressive. I mean, you know, it's a bit like him referring to African countries as S-holes. You know, I don't know whether you consider that racist or not, but it's certainly undiplomatic. But just to touch on, you mentioned Macedonia is in negotiations with NATO to join NATO. The Russians, I understand, are trying to stop that, because the last chance is the deal between Greece and Macedonia. That's the last barrier to the region's European integration. And apparently the Russians are using a billionaire, Ivan Savvidi, who is with a pro-Russian Greek party. So what are the chances of the Russians succeeding there, do you think, in driving a wedge between Greece and Macedonia?
I don't think I'm competent to give you a probability, but I think it's a real risk. The Russians will try in Macedonia as well, but in Macedonia, one quarter of the population is Albanian, and they will turn out for the referendum and vote heavily in favor. In Greece, there's no referendum, as I understand it, but the agreement has to be approved in parliament, and the Greek parliament is not known for its lack of nationalistic fervor. So I think there's a real possibility that the Russians will buy off enough politicians to prevent the approval of the agreement in the Greek parliament. That would be a real disaster for the Balkans as a whole. Everybody in the Balkans is looking forward to this issue being settled in Macedonia, being in NATO and making progress also towards the EU. I think we have to do our maximum to prevent that from happening, and that's hard to do when you have a president who can't see his way to commitment to the mutual defense aspects of the NATO treaty. I think we're in great peril here.
And this is a president who appears almost intimidated by Putin, and the suggestion that Putin may have some compromising hold over him is an extraordinary thing to even contemplate, let alone sort of recognize.
Well, what can I say? I think Mr. Putin has clearly a kind of influence with Mr. Trump that endangers U.S. interests.
And do you think the Republicans are going to step up and rediscover some kind of patriotism?
You know, I think on this Russia question, there are a lot of Republicans uncomfortable with the president's position, and they've voted solidly in favor of sanctions. I think there's a real possibility that the Republicans will turn the president rather than the other way around on this particular subject, and only in the Senate, not in the House, probably.
Well, Daniel Sower, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sower, who's a professor of conflict management at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Previously, he was the vice president for the Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace. And from 1994 to 1996, he served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims and negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton Peace Talks. He also blogs at peacefair.net. We're going to take a brief station break and be analyzing the only possible agreement to emerge from the secret talks between Putin and Trump, and that is the absurd idea that Russia will promise to rein in the Iranians in Syria to help Israel.
تني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the areas of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, James. And in terms of the Arab uprisings, if you look at the history of U.S. intervention in the Middle East following 9/11, first Afghanistan, then Iraq, and then Libya, and then Syria, in every one of those countries, it's been a disaster for the United States. So how do you explain the fact that Russia, a comparatively minor power compared to the United States, has intervened in Syria and appears to have actually won, as opposed to the U.S., who's lost in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria?
Well, I think that the most important thing is the fact that whose side people intervened on. The United States intervened on the side of the opposition in these various cases, in the case of Syria, in the case of Libya, for example. In the case of Afghanistan, we tried to overthrow a government. What the Russians have tried to do is basically bolster a government. And that brings us to the second reason why the Russians have been more successful than we have. It's very easy to bolster up a government. On the one hand, it's much more difficult to overthrow the government and then replace it with something new and better. But more than that, if you're going to care about things like civilian casualties, then you're going to hold back. Now, the Russians did not hold back at all. In terms of firepower, in terms of relieving, for example, Aleppo and the most recent events that took place. In spite of the fact that there was a deconfliction zone in southern Syria, they just went ahead and with the government just made a free fire zone out of the entire thing. So those two things, I think, are very, very important factors that make it appear that the United States is always going to be losing these things, when in fact the United States has been very, very successful in bolstering our friendly governments in the same way that the Russians have been very successful in bolstering their friendly government.
Well, if you're talking about Israel, they certainly don't need a lot of help, even though they're the major recipient of U.S. aid. But that gets me to the central question here about we don't know what went on in these private meetings between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. We got a glimmering from the press conference that followed that Putin seems to almost, you know, control Trump, and Trump is almost afraid of him, defers to him in a craven way. But what we're learning, and by the way, we're learning this from the Russians, not from the American side, because we'd have no idea and the White House has yet to say anything about what they agreed to. But the notion is that there was some kind of agreement between Russia and the United States that would guarantee Israel's security vis-a-vis Syria back under the control of Assad, and somehow that the Russians were going to restrain the Iranians. And I find that almost incomprehensible. I mean, one, I wonder why they do it, since the Iranians are America's enemy. And two, I don't think Russia has any more influence over Iran than we do.
Yes, this is an interesting question. I like the way you framed your question, because you're absolutely right. The Russians really don't have the fingertip control over Iran that maybe Trump thinks they do or Netanyahu thinks they do. What the Russians can do, though, is they can promise us the moon. They can say, for example, look, you know, give us a free hand here, there, and the other place, and we'll keep the Iranians out of Syria. We've seen this sort of thing take place in slow motion over the last couple of days or so. The deconfliction zone, the whole idea of the deconfliction zone in the south was that the Russians promised that these would be areas which were going to be not targeted. And then what they decided at a certain point is, okay, we're ready now to target them, and having mopped up the opposition in other places, so they move into the deconfliction zone as well. I don't know why Netanyahu thinks that the Russians have any sort of ability to force Iran back, but this is something that Netanyahu and the Saudis have been pushing as well. And Netanyahu recently met with the Russians. Maybe Putin thought that this would be a fun thing to talk about with Trump and something that they could agree with. But there's nothing that's going to come out of this. The Iranians, if they choose to stay in Syria, will stay in Syria. Now, that being said, the Iranians are forward deployed. They are extraordinarily vulnerable at this point. And this has been demonstrated time and time again over the last couple of months, whereas the Israelis have been able to inflict real harm on both infrastructure that the Iranians have built and on Iranian troops as well. So whether or not the Iranians actually do move into Syria in a larger force than they have in the past, it's still a question of that.
Well, we know that Donald Trump is totally naive and out of his depth and ignorant, but Netanyahu's been around a long time. I'd be surprised. The greatest insult in Israel is to call somebody a sucker.
Well, I'm not quite sure what is going on here, but I can't believe that somebody who's been around the block as much as Netanyahu has been would actually think that Putin actually has the ability to, quote-unquote, rein in the Iranians. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Now, you have to understand that these things are operating on multiple levels. There's a fantasy level that's taking place among the Israelis as well, because in the old days, countries like Saudi Arabia would say to the Israelis, okay, this is what we can do. We can promise you normalized relations if you do make a deal with the Palestinians. Now what appears to be happening is the Saudis are saying, we will promise you normalized relations if you join our anti-Iranian coalition. And this is a very, very different move. So the Israelis themselves really are not going to be able to have no desire at this point to make peace with the Palestinians. There's no need for it. They won't get anything out of it. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, they're getting everything that they want from the Arab countries without making peace with the Palestinians. So this is the sort of thing that the world that Netanyahu is confronting at the present time.
Well, there have been indications earlier that President Trump was completely willing to sell out the U.S.'s position and by extension, really sell out the Kurds, who are the only reliable boots on the ground that have proven to be allies with the United States. And there was a touchy situation, one with Russian mercenaries, and a number of them were killed. And then there was also a very touchy situation where with a NATO partner, Turkey, almost going to war against or into a military battle with U.S. forces and the Kurds. And at that time, Trump made the announcement that he wanted to get out. And the Pentagon, of course, were alarmed. And now we're told that the Pentagon don't have a clue about what was discussed with the Russians vis-a-vis Syria. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding completely. Amazing, isn't it, the world that we're living in right now, by the way. We sold out the Kurds before. We sold them out in 1975. We sold them out in 1991. There's no reason why we wouldn't sell them out one more time as well. But the problem is that this whole thing has many, many moving parts. You're right. It's got Turkey involved. It's got the Russians involved. It's got people with whom we're allied in the war on terror. The Kurds have been taking on ISIS, for example. So it's got so many moving parts that it's very, very difficult to try to put them all together. And I'm sure for somebody with limited knowledge of the region, as Donald Trump has, he's not going to be able to do it. That being said, where does Trump get his policies from? Well, it appears that in the past he's gotten his policies directly from Netanyahu's government in Israel and also from Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. And these two have interests very much in common. Now it appears also that something is going on with the Russians whereby Trump is trying to figure out some sort of grand strategy. It might involve Crimea, it might involve Ukraine, it might involve something else. But, you know, the idea being that we will sell out Crimea, we will sell out Ukraine in return for this pig and a poke that we're going to buy, the idea of keeping the Iranians out of Syria. And that's the way things are boiling down right now. We will probably come up with some sort of agreement, whether it is secret or not secret. The agreement will last for 30 or 40 seconds.
So the idea that we've got only a couple of thousand special forces in a very key strategic position, they're occupying the oil fields that Assad very much wants. They're also astride what would be a land route between Tehran and Damascus. And you think Trump will just give up that territory, that strategic piece of territory? For nothing?
I have no doubt about that.
For nothing?
For a pig and a poke, as I said, you know, for the idea that Iranians will not come back into Syria. But that, of course, is, as you said, is not a very serious option. I think Trump is into it mainly for the ability to bolster his own ego and the ability to put himself forward as this great peacemaker. He's the one, after all, who denuclearized the Korean Peninsula. He's the one who met with Putin, and all this stuff is coming out now about what they actually talked about. He's also the one who has deployed a son-in-law to come up with this plan for bringing about an Israel-Palestinian peace, which, of course, nobody has seen yet, but which has really no chance of succeeding at all. Trump goes through these motions, so I don't think that we've seen the end of the story yet.
Well, at the press conference, of course, Trump noted that this is the press conference that followed the secret meeting in Helsinki. Trump said, President Putin is also helping Israel, and they would like to do certain things with Syria having to do with the safety of Israel. And we absolutely would like to work in order to help Israel, and Israel will be working with us. So both countries work jointly. Creating safety for Israel is something both Putin and I would like to see very much. Again, apart from the syntax, it's just meaningless. But there's a couple of things that may have some meaning, and I'd like to get your opinion on that. Apparently, Netanyahu, in meeting recently with Putin, managed to get Putin to delay or cancel the sale of sophisticated ground-to-air anti-aircraft missiles to Syria, to the Assad regime. And there's also reports that Russia, perhaps to placate Iran, have agreed to invest in Iranian oil and gas. As you know, their oil and gas fields are depleted from lack of maintenance.
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly these things are happening. I mean, Putin really is winning on every front here. And one of the fronts on which he's winning is to just split up whatever alliance system the United States has been involved in for the last 40, 50 years. One of the things that he's doing is he's driving a wedge between America and its allies. And the idea, of course, of firming up relations with Israel so that Israel can sort of balance out the two powers, looking at the United States as a waning power in the region, is something that they would love nothing more to do. A lot of this stuff is tentative. A lot of this stuff is finding where the openings are and going for those openings. Seeing whether or not, for example, you can overthrow the government of Montenegro and at the same time, not being able to do that, get the United States to withdraw its support from Montenegro. I mean, any time that this stuff is happening at the present time, you have to look at not what is being expected in terms of the immediate return, but in terms of the ability to screw around with the American position in the world.
Well, it's obviously there are ties, longstanding ties between Israel and Russia. I think the Soviet Union was one of the first countries to recognize the new state of Israel.
It was the first, was it?
And I don't know what these ties are. I mean, there's a lot of Russian emigration, of course, in the 1980s to Israel, and it has changed the political dynamics there. There's also an awful lot of Russian gangsters there. A lot of money laundering goes on. Transparency International rates Israel as one of the worst countries in the world for money laundering. So given that Russia is a kleptocracy run by a kind of organized crime boss, who kind of regulates these, the Siloviki, these oligarchs and former intelligence officials, could that be a tie with Israel?
It could be, but I would go for something a little bit more obvious, which is that after 8 years of Obama, whom the Israelis could not stand, whom they detested, and the reason why they detested Obama was fundamentally he was saying that the United States wants to turn its attention elsewhere. So what we want you to do is clean up your act, resolve this Palestinian issue, and just tamp down the tensions within the region. And of course, Netanyahu went ballistic, came to the United States, denounced, for example, the nuclear deal that the United States had done with the Iranians, which also, by the way, was part of Obama's strategy of calming the waters in the Middle East. So you have this thing where the United States is trying to withdraw from the Middle East and turn its attention to East Asia, which was Obama's grand strategy. Then you get Trump, and Trump is the Israelis undoubtedly know Trump very, very well. They know his limited capabilities. So you have somebody who the Israelis perceived as being hostile to their interests for 8 years. Now you have somebody for the next 4 years who they perceive as unable to actually stand up for Israeli interests. If I was an Israeli prime minister, I would certainly hedge my bets as well. Look to the new boy on the block in the Middle East. Look to Russia. See what the Russians are willing to do. I mean, the Russians demonstrated in Syria that when it comes to implementing policy, there is nothing like human rights or civilian casualties that will stand in their way. So the Israelis, are just looking at this side as well, looking in every crevice they possibly can for, to make sure that they're going to be on the winning side when this all comes to a head.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.